Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. State and city officials gather to formally dedicate the second segment of Skyline. The rail project opens for the riding public bright and early tomorrow morning. We continue to examine how it could be a game changer for those who work at the airport and for travelers. We bid aloha to the historic vessel. The Falls of Clyde left Honolulu Harbor for the last time this morning. Just before daybreak, HPR was there. It's an open call for ideas on how to use the new green fee. Starting today, the public gets to provide input and proposals for how to use millions of dollars in fees from the visitor industry to improve our island home. We also meet a native honey creeper, presumed extinct in this week's Manu Minute. And from birds to bugs, we go on a hunt for big beetles on the Big Island. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. At this hour, officials are gathered to bless the second segment of the rail system. Skyline officially opens to the public at 4 a.m. tomorrow. It'll operate from the Aloha Stadium at Halawa with new stations at Pearl Harbor, the Honolulu Airport, Lagoon Drive, and Middle Street. We heard about the Pearl Harbor service for the thousands of workers at the shipyard and the joint base from the city yesterday. Today, we take a closer look at the airport as a major employment center. We sat down with State Transportation Director Ed Sniffen to talk about easing the pressure with parking and creating commercial opportunities in the airport area.
We have about 17,000 employees that work at the airport at any given time, generally about 5,000 at a time. So if we look at the parking that we have about 800 state employees. They pay about $35 a month for their parking. The airlines employees that come through are about $175 a month. So people who want to use rail to get in versus driving in could have a significant savings in monthly costs for them. It'll also provide opportunities for the airport to adjust our parking structures to ensure that we can service more people.
Do the majority of state employees park in the lot here, or do they park off premise?
The majority of the state employees don't park in the lots next to the terminals, but we can start repurposing some of the areas that they do park in once we start moving them towards rail. The cool thing about rail, when it starts coming through, we have people who already catch the bus. Some of them have to walk out to Nimitz. Sometimes they go through and past some difficulties, some homeless people, and having rail stop it right at the airport is going to make it way easier for all of our staff to go through. And I'm hopeful that many who are catching their airlines daily or weekly could also take advantage of rail as it comes through. If they're living in areas where on the west side, where it's easier for them to come in on rail, they don't have to pay the $27 a day parking that they do now. They don't have to drive in the traffic as they get here. So we're hopeful that they can take advantage of that. We've been working with our employees, giving presentations to the airline employees about the benefits and what's available. And all of them, there's many that are interested. So we working with John Mouchi and Roger Morton at the Department of Transportation Services, we handed out about 5,000 holocards to airlines and airport employees who are interested in potentially catching a rail and bus.
I know that one concern is you're just getting from point A to point B in time for your shift. At the airport train station, those were designed without escalators, right?
That's correct. But there's two levels to them, one at the ground level and one at the mezzanine level. Ground level will connect you up into the baggage area. Mezzanine level will connect you up into fourth floor on the Terminal 2 side and fifth floor on the Terminal 1 side. Both of them will get you right to the elevator. So we've already set up the signage and the striping to get you right to those locations. Terminal 2 side, you can either jump in the elevator or go right across the sky bridges. Terminal 1 side, you can catch the elevator up or down wherever you need to be. So it makes it really easy for everybody to use.
And then integration with, let's say, the airlines, like Hawaiian Air, I know their lot is off by Rogers, by their hangar on the other side. But they have a shuttle service, right? So hopefully then that will help with moving people around?
Absolutely. Reduce the cost of employees, but also reduce the cost for the employer. If more are catching rail, more are connected directly to the terminal, less of these types of operations that are necessary to get people to and from the parking lot to their work zone would be necessary.
And then what about with the vendors? What have you heard as far as feedback from them?
Oh, they're excited. So many, like I said, many of the people who work at the airport already catch the bus. They're excited about the change to rail. Less transfers, a lot easier to go. The vendors are pushing the opportunities to their employees. And we're still asking if anybody else wants holocards. We're now up to 5,000. So we're looking at trying to see if we can get more.
I don't know. Any sense as to what percentage of employees will actually jump on?
Not yet. I think the proof is in the pudding. Right? When rail starts up, we'll start seeing the adjustments. We'll start seeing the reductions in parking in different areas. I would give it about 6 months to make sure that it normalizes itself before we make any changes to operations based on the reductions.
And then what about, let's say, people who may want to jump on rail and fly out of here?
Oh, that's the hope. So we're hoping that more people will start taking that opportunity to catch rail. Again, it's $27 a day for people to park at the airport. And we're happy to accommodate them if they want to do that. We'd love to see more people catching rail to come in to make sure we can open up some of the spaces and more would be available, especially during the heavy travel seasons. It'll be better for people who can save money on the parking rates that they have. It'll be better for us to make sure that we have more parking stalls available for everybody else.
I believe the city buses are on the second level. That may change then come Thursday?
So we're making adjustments. We have an area near the lay stands available for the city buses so they can queue there to service rail. There may be adjustments in the future, but that's where it's going to be for now.
Anything else that you think people ought to know as you try and encourage people to take advantage of this new service?
Yeah, we appreciate the city, HART, and Department of Transportation Services in pushing this far to get rail here. We appreciate them reaching out early to make sure we could partner to make it as easy as possible for people to use that service to get into and out of the airport. And we're going to make sure that we keep making tweaks. So we're hoping that people will take advantage of the service that's coming through and keep giving feed in to the city and to the state on how we can make things better. So we've seen Pearl Harbor, Joint Base Pearl Harbor Base Commander, really excited about the potentials for their workers coming into the bases to be able to catch rail coming through. They're excited about the potential of working with us in the future to put in some kind of commercial opportunities outside of our airports, potentially service rail. When rail gets into the city, when somebody's done with work, we'd love for them to have the opportunity to jump off really easy at the airport, go pick up the goods that they need, jump back on rail, and go home.
So it's really not just a transportation driver, but maybe an economic driver too.
Oh, absolutely. I think rail is going to open up significant opportunities for commercial here near the airport and around it.
Anything with people who may want to jump on? I mentioned this to John the other day that I interviewed a guy who was looking forward to taking Skyline to go Vegas.
So I think Skyline will offer a lot of opportunities for many. I think a lot of us in Hawaii have been so married to our vehicles. I would just challenge everybody to try it. Try it in small opportunities. So when next time you're going to fly out, try and see what it would look like for you to take your bag onto the bus to connect up to the rail station and take rail or take Skyline out to the airport. I think everybody will see how easy and seamless it is. Next time you're going to go to a UH football game, use the opportunity to catch rail to Middle Street to make sure that it's a lot easier for you to get in from that portion there using the bus. So if we can start envisioning how we could use these opportunities that the city's providing, I think it's a lot easier for us to consider what life is going to be like without our cars.
And while we were at the airport, we did check in with the airport lay sellers. They are hopeful that when the buses are rerouted near their stands tomorrow, they will see business pick up. We talked to a cross-section of airport workers. Some say they work graveyard shifts or live in Windward or Central Oahu, so rail won't work for them. Some also work multiple jobs, and it isn't convenient for their schedules. But others, like a state worker named Rowena, are willing to give it a try to save money.
Do you think you might try it?
Yes, I will.
And how far do you live from here?
I live in Kalihi.
So you might have to take a bus to get
yes,
to
Yes, I will. I'll try. I normally catch Uber, a ride share, yeah, but I want to try that.
It might be cheaper. Better for you.
Yeah, better for me. Could save more.
And you think it's going to work out with your schedule?
I should be because I start at 7:30. I get off 4 o'clock, but I have another job. I go straight to my other job. It's within the airport, too.
But it may work for you.
Yeah, I believe it would work. It should work. It must work.
Good luck.
Thank you so much.
And a former Honolulu resident who flew back home this week for a visit was excited to hear about Skyline's extension. Lisa Oshiro can't wait to try it, and maybe on her next return trip, we'll give it a go.
I used to live in the Eawaipahu area, yeah.
And so you shared with me that you watch rail getting built?
Oh, all around, all the stops and the traffic and the middle of the night noise, and it was awful for a while. But then when it started taking shape, unfortunately, I moved to the mainland, but when I've just heard it's been great, Unfortunately, there's not enough park and rides is what I've heard from friends. That so if I had somewhere to park, I'd take it, but I'm excited to try it. I want to go out Kapolei and come back, maybe stop in Waipahu for lunch, or it'll be fun.
We will continue our coverage of Skyline this week while keeping an eye on the labor dispute between the Teamsters, which represents the bus drivers, and Oahu Transit Services, which manages the bus. The public will get a chance, again, as we mentioned, to jump on the train starting at 4 a.m. tomorrow. And on the weekend, passengers with holo cards will be able to ride the bus and rail for free.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
Joseph Stalin was a ruthless Soviet dictator who embraced quack science, manipulated the media, consolidated personal power, and developed an enormous cult of personality. President Trump and Stalin are different men from different times and countries, but there are enough nagging similarities that some wonder, what lessons should Americans learn from Stalinism now? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Singer-songwriter Guapele performs a blend of R&B, soul, jazz, and pop with songs such as Closer, this Saturday in two sets. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Officials say that by now the historic vessel, the Falls of Clyde, will be near its final resting place, some 25 miles off Oahu's south shore. HPR was there at Aloha Tower just before daybreak as two tugboats hauled the last iron-hulled tanker out into Honolulu Harbor for its final journey. It had been docked at Pier 8 for decades as a struggle to save it and turn it into a museum played out. It had been declared a National Historic Landmark and then delisted last year when efforts to return it to Scotland failed. At 5 this morning, a handful of people were dockside to witness the end of a long saga, including Don, a maritime historian with the group The Friends of the Falls of Clyde.
It's a sad day. I wouldn't have missed it, but it was very sad to see it happen. It's sad to look at the Hawaii Maritime Center and what remains of the Hawaii Maritime Center and see an empty slip there.
It's a void.
It is definitely a void.
The state did allow members of the Friends of Falls of Clyde to say goodbye to the vessel at noon yesterday. It was a tough last visit for Bruce McEwen, who we talked to this morning and whose heart was heavy. I guess what was top of mind for you as you reflected back?
Well, to be blunt about it, on top of mind was that after 10 years of trying to get the ship removed, the state finally met its goal. And so that's what made it even more bittersweet, because we known over the years that the outcome could have been different if the state's position would have been different.
And you did try to get her back to Glasgow, and you had the group over there make a bid for this.
Right. I mean, we were totally independent from them, but we were supportive of their effort to try to get the ship returned. We thought that would have been actually a very positive result of her removal from the harbor, would be going back to where she was originally built.
And for our listeners who may not be familiar with this vessel, tick down her history.
Well, she was built in Port Glasgow, Scotland in 1878, launched December 12th, 1878. Then, you know, the main connection with Hawaii came in at the turn of the century when Captain Matson bought her to sail between the West Coast and Hawaii. And, of course, that lasted only a fairly short period of time in terms of the life of the ship because steam took over sail. And then, of course, she went the ownership to some oil companies and then ended up in Alaska as a bunker barge for the fishing fleet out of Ketchikan. And then everybody felt that her life was ended there. She was brought down to Seattle at that point thinking she was going to be a part of the breakwater in Vancouver, Canada. And ultimately, John Wright and Bob Krause decided, no, she belonged here in back here in Hawaii. And she came back here in 1963, restored initially in the 70s, turned over to Bishop Museum in the late 80s. And by this time, she had historical recognition both for the state and on the national level, and was under the stewardship of Bishop Museum from about 1989 until the museum gave her up in 2008. And then that's when we stepped in.
Well, I just remember being there at Aloha Tower when the Italian ship, the Amerigo Vespucci,
right,
was docked there. And it was such a juxtaposition of a historic ship with all the backing and in tip-top shape, still in use, and then to look over there to the other side of the pier and see the Falls of Clyde languishing.
Yeah, you know, obviously we felt bad about it because she was under our stewardship at that point in time, but it was the prior owner neglect that got her in that condition.
You know, I guess as you look back on this, I mean, you tried everything you could to save her. But that was not to be.
We entered this whole project back when we took possession in 2008. We thought, and somewhat naively, I guess, that if we learned about the technical aspects of restoring a historical ship, that we would be successful. And at the end of 2014, we thought we had the proper strategy in place. We had a dry dock plan from a well-respected engineering company. We had a business plan that made it clear that once the dry dock was done and her hull was stable, that we would phase in restoration of the ship over a period of decades. That's, again, being probably too naive. We felt that that made enough sense that the state would support us. And then, of course, starting at the end of 2014, when they ignored both the business plan and the dry dock plan, in 2015, they started their campaign to undermine our work and get rid of the ship.
That was Bruce McEwen with Friends of the Falls of Clyde. And Deputy Harbors Director Dre Khalili was on scene bright and early at the docks to see the saga of the vessel come to an end.
It is gone. We've just watched it sail across the Turning Basin and through the harbor entrance, and we can just barely see it approaching the horizon. It's definitely, you know, an occasion with mixed, I think, emotions and thoughts about this. But I think from this standpoint, we can say the removal from the harbor has occurred. It's something that we felt needed to happen, given the deteriorating condition of the vessel. And that decision is what has brought us here today.
Well, I know there was great concern that while this thing was being towed, that something would happen and it would sink and clog our harbor, which is not a good thing.
Yeah, since July, our contractor has been working to reinforce the vessel so that it could successfully be removed from the port. That's what we've seen so far this morning. In a couple of hours, we'll get a report on the actual ocean disposal process.
How was the site determined, the final resting place for Plaza Clyde?
Sure. So the permitting process through the U.S. EPA has requirements and standards that must be met. And in collaboration with both the EPA as well as the United States Coast Guard, we looked at a couple of different options. And things that are considered are the environment, critical fish habitats, and other factors. And a couple of sites were evaluated. And the one that was selected is about 25 miles offshore due south of Honolulu Harbor.
So then what happens now to this slip here at the harbor?
It's been several decades since we've been able to access the pier where the vessel was formerly berthed. And so what we're going to do is we're going to have our team assess the condition of the pier. It's actually in pretty bad shape. There's a wooden portion of the pier that has been condemned for many years. So we will do an assessment. We'll figure out what improvements need to be made to restore it to active maritime operations. And we will start to make some decisions about projects that we need to carry out there.
And then you were able to relocate the vessel that normally takes tourists out for cruises, just as a precaution?
Yes. So usually, berth at Pier 8 is the Star of Honolulu, and they've been relocated elsewhere in Honolulu Harbor just so we had enough waterway to get the two key tugs that needed to pull the Falls of Clyde off the pier. But the Star of Honolulu's operations will resume later this morning.
Anything else you want to say, just because this really is the end for the ship?
Yeah. You know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, there are mixed thoughts and emotions with this, but we really were focused on just keeping the port safe. It's incredibly important to our islands, to our state economy. But I think the important thing is, in terms of preserving the history and memorializing this vessel that was here in our harbors and served our islands when it did, we will be installing a permanent display to more memorialize the ship. We recovered some of the artifacts from the vessel, so those will be on display within the year. And I think another thing of importance is there is another Scottish-built ship that is in the San Francisco Maritime Museum, and some of the artifacts from the vessel have been transferred to the museum. It will be part of their interpretation and their display of the Balclutha, and some of the rigging tools that were removed from the Falls of Clyde will be used to rig and maintain that vessel. So I think there is still life of the Falls of Clyde that will continue, well, not in Hawaii, but you know, its history will be remembered and celebrated.
That was State Harbor's Deputy Dre Kalili, who was at the Aloha Tower Marketplace before daybreak to watch the towing of the historic Falls of Clyde ship out of Honolulu. The vessel would have turned 147 years old on December 12th. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We will be taking our show on the road to Chinatown next week, where we plan to broadcast live and ponder the future of the neighborhood. But for today's quiz, we're testing your knowledge on a piece of Chinatown history. The noted architectural firm Emery and Webb designed an iconic hotel that opened back in 1913. The Blaisdell Hotel does, in fact, have a connection to Mayor Neil Blaisdell. It was presided over by his grandmother, Cora. It sits on Fort Street, and when it opened, it was advertised as Honolulu's newest and most modern hotel. These days, however, the hotel is known for being the site of the last example of a certain technology. Hint, it's known as a birdcage, and current tenants say this piece of technology is a must for transporting heavy musical equipment. Can you tell us what working piece of technology in the old Blaisdell Hotel is the last of its kind in Hawaii, call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we unpack the ceasefire agreement in Gaza with veteran State Department negotiator Aaron David Miller. He says the Gaza deal isn't a lasting peace agreement, but an important step made possible in part by President Trump's transactional approach to politics and diplomacy. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Starting today, the public is being asked to weigh in on how the new so-called green fee should be spent to improve our lives. It's expected the fee levied on the visitor industry could generate about $100 million annually. It's to enhance natural resources, help with resilience, and offset tourist impacts across our communities. Jeff Michelina is the head of the Green Fee Advisory Council. He stopped by our studio yesterday to set the scene for what's to come.
So folks are aware the green fee is something that the legislature passed this last session. It's been a priority of Governor Green, his leadership over the past few years. But this is an idea that's been around for a while. Can we tap into some of those tourism funds, namely the hotel tax, and use that to support natural resources, to support climate resilience, and to support regenerative tourism so we have a more positive visitor experience when they're here? Okay. So really a novel idea, first in the nation, to use some of these tourism dollars to support that the place that we love. This will start January 1st. The tax will be collected. And then our task on the Green Fee Council, which is a hui of 10 individuals from around the state, is to help the governor kind of shape that initial portfolio of projects that he will then request through a supplemental budget appropriation to the legislature. And the legislature will ultimately be the ones appropriating those funds to departments.
I know in the stories that we've been doing this year, one thing that's popped up is, do we use some of that money to deal with the coastal erosion and building a new beach over there in Waikiki, you know, near the Halekulani, to create more, not green space, but beachfront, things like that.
Yes and yes. And these are exactly the needs that this green fee should be focused on. That's probably visitor experience. We know that whole coastline is eroding. It's always been a challenge. That's not the only place. Around the state, we have the same challenge with coastal erosion. So shoreline protection, certainly a big focus. But then also wildfire protection. Unfortunately, Lahaina really sharpened our imagination about the threat of wildfire. So we certainly hope to dedicate some funds to wildfire protection, removing non-native flammable grasses, replacing with native trees, native plants. But then this really runs the gamut, everything from the visitor experience to coral reef protection to native restoration, and then maybe even structural climate resilience too. We have so many homes in Hawaii that are going to be vulnerable. If and when that hurricane comes, can we strengthen rooftops and help just build our resilience statewide? So these are all the projects that we're going to be looking at. We have a whole list of projects already, but we are inviting community input now too to hear what are the needs, what are some potential projects that this green fee could go support.
And then we should note, though, that there is a short fuse. If folks have ideas, they've got to be able to come up with proposals in a couple of weeks.
Exactly. And this is just some of the constraints that we face because of the legislative cycle. So this first go-around is going to be real truncated. We hope as a council, we'll be developing a process going forward for subsequent years. We anticipate this will raise about $100 million annually, which seems like a lot of money, but given our needs, it's really a drop in the bucket. The climate advisory team looked at the scope of needs for climate resilience, and they came up with a number of, we could be facing impacts of about $1.4 billion annually. This is one of these cases where, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth many pounds of cure. And so we hope to really, in this first year, prioritize high impact, visual projects that people can feel in year one, so they can see the real power of this green fee.
We've also heard some conversations from folks who are concerned about the Olawai, the watershed project, and all the garbage that comes. We're rushing down to the boat harbor, and that is really a part of Waikiki, but it often gets overlooked.
Yeah, flood protection could also be one of those projects. And again, as soon as you start looking at this, you see how extensive the needs are, and it's really going to be a challenge for us to prioritize and go through that list and see which projects are ready to go, have high impact, and ideally have some matching funds or leverage so each dollar of this green fee goes much further.
And I don't know, I know you folks had a meeting recently just to brainstorm, right? To talk about what the landscape looks like at this point. But I don't know, anything come out of there that piqued your interest? Oh gosh, we didn't consider that.
The council has 10 voices on it, and certainly a multitude of ideas. We've been meeting weekly. We'll be receiving the departmental priorities shortly. And then we're very curious to see what the community has, because a lot of folks are doing fascinating, important work, and we don't necessarily have visibility into that. So that's what we're hoping to solicit through this intake process. We know that the community holds a lot of knowledge, doing great work, and we really want to amplify and uplift those communities to the extent we can. We are somewhat constrained that these dollars need to flow through departments. So we're actively, you know, investigating alternative mechanisms to be able to support community groups, nonprofits that are doing this work, understanding that we have these constraints, that the funding will go through departments.
How do you also make sure it's equitable when we talk about the many islands that make up Hawaii?
Yeah, geographic diversity is key, certainly. And so what we're doing is developing sort of an evaluation rubric. So as we see these proposals, we'll vet them through this lens of priorities, geographic diversity, impact, cost-benefit analysis, how quickly they can be executed and timing. And these are all things we're working through now. So we have a fairly solid rubric to pass the proposals through and vet them.
Will there be a mix of short-term and long-term projects?
We hope so. Again, this is a fairly constrained challenge. The funds need to be spent or encumbered in the first year in a regular budget cycle. But that doesn't mean that we can't have multi-year projects. So we'll be looking at a mix of things that can be executed quickly and then things where we need to plant the seed and build a longer-term sort of project. We view it through the lens, one of our members, Janice, uses the phrase, are we planting kalo or planting koa? And we hope to be planting both, and both harvesting things in the near term, but planting seeds for longer impact.
So what are the general estimates as to how much this green fee will generate?
It's about $100 million annually. Now, the first year, since it starts in January and the budget cycle starts in July, probably anticipating about $140 million that will be flowing through departments in this first year.
I'm just thinking, just given the climate, political climate, there's so many factors beyond our control that could impact our visitor numbers.
True. Yeah, a lot of factors right now. Climate, our economy, the government shutdown, obviously. But this is part of the magic behind the green fee, is really finding a dedicated source of funding to protect natural resources. The legislature supported this, obviously a priority of the governor, and really thinking, how do we have that dedicated source of funding for natural resources and climate resilience and not have to be subject to annual appropriations or individual asks, but really having a dedicated set aside for this work. Certainly, there are going to be risks. We have a lot of constraints, namely time for this first go around. Always challenges with executing projects in a timely manner in Hawaii. So we really hope to identify those that are shovel ready, that we can start seeing results and impacts in year one.
If I recall right, though, I think one of the recommendations was that we charge a fee for our cruise ship passengers, and they have pushed back.
They have pushed back, which is unfortunate because we think they're all part of valuing and using the resources in Hawaii. That's out of our purview. We hope that sticks. And irrespective of the lawsuit, we hope they see the value in contributing to this fund to support natural resources and climate resilience, just because it's so important. And if we do our jobs right and deploy these funds appropriately, hopefully folks see benefits that are many times multiplied than the fee itself is collecting.
Okay. What can you tell us about the bonds that have been proposed to help leverage this money?
Yeah, leverage is a key factor for this because, again, $100 million annually isn't going to be enough. So there was hope that we'd be able to bond this funds to do longer-term, larger projects. Unfortunately, the way the legislation has been drafted, it's not a special fund, so we're not able to do that in year one. We hope to go back in subsequent legislative cycles and get that capacity and create a special fund so we can really look at leveraging those dollars and doing long-term projects.
Anything else that you think could be important to underscore to our listeners?
Again, we're really hoping the community can go to the website, greenfeehawaii.org, and provide their thoughts on needs, on potential projects, and just help us with our thinking in developing this first go-around of proposals for year one, while we think of longer-term cycles, year two and year three.
Is there any place that you can point to that this is being modeled after, or were it successful?
There was inspiration taken from Palau. Palau has a similar fee,
the
Costa Rica
pledge.
As well. Yep, exactly, New Zealand. But in the United States, we're one of the first. So there's really not a manual to follow here. And that's why our work is, it's exciting because it's open-ended, but we're also making this up as we go.
Okay. All right. That's important, yeah, to note. Okay. And then you just got to drive people to the website. And then the deadline is November 1st?
November 1st for public input, but that won't be the last time. We hope to be doing a lot of social media, requesting, soliciting input, hopefully some further community meetings. We did a webinar last month. We hope to do that again in the future. And then it'll be the legislative process. It will be inviting the community to come and support the projects that they believe in.
Okay. So this is not the only bite at the apple. And that, yeah, as these proposals then get vetted out. And then how many, do you have a number that you're sitting on? We want to do six or we want to do, wide open?
Yeah, we really don't. We do hope to have a mix of smaller and larger projects. Again, I think prejudicing projects that will be high impact in year one. So those that are shovel ready, those that people will feel and experience. But we also recognize that a lot of these projects that are important, say watershed protection, are sometimes out of sight. And yet they yield benefits that we all experience. So it will be a mix of projects.
That was Jeff Mikulina of the Green Fee Advisory Council. We will have links for more info on our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
I mean, look, as someone who covers the Justice Department and the FBI, I will tell you that there are many corruption cases that are hard to just unravel and unpack. You know what is easy to explain? A cava bag full of cash. That's pretty simple.
So I think for the foreseeable future, wherever Tom Homan goes, he's going to be asked that question. What did you do with the money?
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Now on view, Lyrically Rebellious, the Prince of Onchi Koshido, a pioneer of abstract art in Japan. HonoluluMuseum.org.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. On today's Mano Minute, we've got the call of a honey creeper, the o'u, thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. This native bird hasn't been seen in the wild in decades, but scientists are holding out hope that its song may be heard again. Here's your host, University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
The o'u was once one of the most common of the Hawaiian honeycreepers across all the main Hawaiian islands, but was just recently declared extinct by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's about 7 inches long, with males having a distinctive bright yellow head and a brownish-green body, while females are duller and without the yellow head. Both sexes use their unusual parrot-like hooked bill to forage on a variety of native forest fruits, such as Ieie, Ohemauka, and Ohavai. As one of the only frugivorous, or fruit-eating, Hawaiian honey creepers, they're considered to have played a very important ecological role as seed dispersers across the forest, and would sometimes even venture down into lowland areas to forage on mountain apples, papayas, and other backyard fruits. The sweet, clear song of the male was a people's favorite, and it begins with a few distinctive whistled notes and ends with a series of downward notes known as a trill. Unfortunately, o'u numbers started to drastically decline in the early to middle 20th century, primarily due to mosquito-transmitted disease, and the last o'u were detected on Hawaii Island in 1987 and Kauai in 1989. Because o'u habitat is in dense wet forests not often visited by bird watchers, there's still hope among optimistic biologists that a few of these birds may still be out there somewhere. In fact, there's been a handful of credible potential sightings in the past few years on the Big Island. New bird detection techniques, such as placing automated recorders across the landscape, or even using eDNA, may help us get an updated answer as to whether the song of the o'u will ever be heard again in our forests. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Now it's time to elevate the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you a bit about the history of the Blaisdell Hotel on Fort Street. Its original owner, Cora Blaisdell, leased its operation to J. Francis Child. When Prohibition was repealed, the hotel was one of the first establishments in Hawaii to obtain a liquor license. Even when the Blaisdell Hotel stopped housing visitors, it provided low-rent space for tenants. In the 1980s and 90s, the Gay Community Center and the American Civil Liberties Union were headquartered on the block. We asked you to name a bygone piece of technology that can still be seen functioning at the old Blaisdell Hotel. It is a birdcage elevator, the last of its kind to be manually operated in Hawaii. Congrats to Simon from Hanalei, who got it right. That's our quiz today. If you have one to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday when the conversation will be broadcasting live from Honolulu's Chinatown.
Hawaii Public Radio amplifies voices from all across the Hawaiian island.
News, Ike Kupuna, Mele Mo'olelo, and more.
All in today's episode of the Hawaii Radio Hour from Kahilu.
From Hawaii Island comes Hawaii Radio Hour, part of our weekend lineup on HPR One and available as a podcast.
As Hawaiians, we live with one foot on this side in the here and the other foot in the hereafter. And for us, the ancestors are present in a real way.
Hawaii Radio Hour is part of our continued commitment to elevate Hawaii's diverse and distinct voices. Support Hawaii Public Radio's commitment to local programs. Become a monthly supporter by clicking donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
The island of Hawaii has been ground zero for so many invasive species, little fire ant and koki frog, to name a few. But efforts are underway to block the coconut rhinoceros beetle from taking hold. HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote got a chance to get out in the field recently with crews combating the pest and joins us now. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so you were out the other day.
Yes, I was. And this is part of several things that are happening in Kona to combat the beetle. 125 adult beetles have been detected, as well as multiple piles of beetle larvae in different green waste piles and mulch piles throughout the Kona area. And I went out with Franny Brewer, who's the program manager of the Big Island Invasive Species Committee. And she said that when this infestation started in March, they put essentially all of their resources towards eradicating coconut rhinoceros beetle in Kona.
Currently, this is our number one priority, because with any invasive species, you have a window of time in which it might be possible to eradicate it. And this one, we're still in that window. So when you have that very, very small amount of time, you want to give it everything that you have.
Yeah, it's so important to, you know, hit it big right at the start.
Yeah, yeah. And I met up with Brewer at the Teoholei Agricultural Park. For folks who are not from Hawaii Island, they may be familiar with this place. It's about a mile from the Kona Airport across the road, and it looks like this little oasis, essentially, in all of the black lava fields in the areas. It's home to a bunch of local landscaping businesses and plant nurseries. But unfortunately, that makes it great territory for the beetle to spread. And Brewer says it's likely that the current infestation that Hawaii Island has been dealing with for the last 6 months started in that ag park and has spread out from there.
We're a faith-based company, and I'm always asking God, how come I didn't just go into pools or selling rock and stones and stuff that's not alive? Why did you give me this business that is so hard to keep these plants alive? Like, sometimes the plants can get sick, the plants can get not get enough water, get too much water, get, you know, but the insects is a whole other aspect. And the more that we get these invasive ones that are introduced, the harder it becomes. Like, I don't know what we're going to do if we can't keep that side of our business going, because, you know, we've got to be able to make money to survive somehow. The mangoes aren't enough. We've got over 80 mango trees here, but, you know, we can't, that just barely covers the water bill. It doesn't even cover the water bill, just the mango sales. I don't know. I don't have an answer for what we're going to do if, you know, if these things really, because it could wipe out, in 10 years, things are going to look drastically different if we don't get on top of it.
So Savannah, what's being done to combat the beetle?
That's Kaz DeMarco who was talking there, and he has a nursery in the ag park, Ilikupono Gardens. And you can hear him start to get a little existential. To give you some more context, he grows 50 varieties of palms in that nursery, and the revenue that's generated from the sale of those palms is about half of the income that his business makes. And so it's not just the beetle he's contending with. It's also little fire ant. It's also a plumeria borer, a stinging nettle caterpillar. All of these things are making people in the area, as you can hear Kaz say, really feel like this is an insurmountable task. But there are things that are being done. So if you go to the Teoholei Ag Park, it's absolutely dotted with beetle traps. And in some places, like the Kona Airport across the street, they've taken the step of injecting palm trees with insecticides. So if a beetle comes along and takes a bite of a treated tree, it'll die. And in mid-August, in that ag park, they fumigated several waste piles and where they found beetle larvae. And there have been restrictions voluntary on the movement of possible host materials out of the infected area. And then something exciting that was happening when I was out there yesterday with Brewer, she had some colleagues down from Hilo, the University of Hilo, and they were employing a strategy that was actually developed for surveying for rapid ohia death. And it's a special camera that's rigged to the bottom of a helicopter. And yesterday they flew it over the ag park as well as the large residential area directly above the ag park, Kona Palisades, on the slope of Hualalai. And that helps them look for signs of beetle damage or green waste piles that may need to be treated. And in total, they were able to survey about 4,500 acres just in one day.
As you can see, looking up the mountain, we're looking at thousands of homes, right? Thousands of properties, going door to door and knocking on everybody's door and saying, hey, do you have a palm tree? Do you have a pile of mulch in your backyard? Right? That's a lot of work. This is really going to help us narrow down where we want to go and start talking to folks in their neighborhoods and start saying, hey, we have a dog. Do you mind if we bring the dog in to just sniff around? Looks like you have some piles of soil or decomposing material here, you know, and this will really help us target our resources.
And so a lot of the resources are being concentrated in that Keohole and the Kona Palisades neighborhood because that's hot beetle territory. But beetles have been detected in a pretty broad swath of Kona at this time. So far, two beetles have made it as far north as Tiholo State Park Reserve. That's about a 20-minute drive from the airport, 10 miles up the coast. And that reserve is home to this just beautiful strip of black sand beach, and it's dotted with fish ponds and H-aligned pools. And throughout the reserve, coconut palms offer a lot of shade, some of which were planted by the Hine family, a family of ranchers that used to have all of the land all the way from the mountain down to the shore more than 150 years ago. And they also have ancient groves of lulu in Kiholo, or endemic fan palms. And coconut rhinoceros beetles will readily make a meal out of lulu. They're particularly susceptible to beetle damage. And so I spoke with a community group, Hui Aloha Kiholo, who's been working with the state to steward the area, and they're very concerned about the presence of beetles in that area. They've been working hard to manage mulch piles and monitor beetle traps, but a lot of the area is inaccessible because of really dense Tiave forests. And they're also limited in how they can treat trees at that location.
Based on the research we've been able to do, we haven't identified any treatment that works that can be applied in close proximity to aquatic habitats. The reason we need a treatment method that can be applied close to water is because the groundwater lens under Kiholo is very close to the surface at the shoreline. And there are a lot of sensitive native ecosystems, including ankyline pools and fish ponds, that would be directly affected by any kind of a toxin that enters that groundwater system. So we need a non-toxic treatment method, and I'm not aware of any that has been shown to work yet.
Yeah, that's the tricky part, right? No real surefire solution.
Yeah, and lulu is something that came up again and again as something that different resource managers and community members want to preserve. Hawaii Island has the largest percentage of lulu in the state, and there's a living collection, actually, at the Amy Greenwell Ethnobotanical Gardens in South Kona. They're a little bit out of the area in which coconut rhinoceros beetle has been detected so far, but they've taken the step of injecting some of the specimens in their collection with insecticides in order to prevent the beetle from damaging those species because they're so fragile. And also, lulu don't really store well. You can't really make a seed bank of lulu. So the garden manager that I talked to there said, you need to be able to have these wild collected living species if you're going to be able to perpetuate lulu for the years to come.
Yes, and those native species are so critical. I know on Kauai at the National Tropical Botanical Garden, they are concerned about their lulu trees there as well. But thanks so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HPR's Savannah Herman-Pote. Look for her story on hawaiipublicradio.org. We do have to go now. We're out of time. But up tomorrow, we plan to hear from a Palestinian man living in Hawaii. He recently returned from the West Bank. We get his thoughts on the Gaza ceasefire and the future. Do you think you will ride rail? We would like to know what you think. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.